I feel really sorry for giving this elementary talk,
which is mainly pedagogical, in such an audience, which is
so refined
and educated.
But if some of you teach,
then I believe it would be of interest to you.
This is the abstract of my talk, and I will read and comment. The concept of mass is often misinterpreted in the literature. One can find a host of various masses: relativistic mass, rest mass, inertial mass, gravitational mass, active mass, passive mass, while in fact there exists only one mass. And for massive bodies, it is an ordinary Newtonian mass. Photon has vanishing mass, within certain limits, of course, experimental limits. Its behavior in a given gravitational field is determined by its energy-momentum tensor, not by the mass. The correct explanation of the gravitational redshift is not the loss of photon's energy as it climbs out of the gravitational potential, but the fact that clocks, atoms, nuclei, run faster at higher altitudes at larger distances from gravitating bodies. So there will be two parts in this talk. One part is very short, and it is on the concept of mass in special relativity, just one transparency. It was more than 10 years ago when I was touring the west coast and east coast of the United States, giving talk on the mass in the theory of relativity. And at each place I started the talk with opinion poll. There are four equations: E sub zero equals mc squared, equation one. E sub zero equals, I'm sorry. E sub zero mc squared. Then E equals mc squared. Then E0 equals m0c squared. And finally, E0 equals mc squared. So there are m here and m0 here. Something is wrong, yeah? Sorry? Now it's okay. And so the question I asked at that time was, which of these equations expresses in the most adequate way the essence of special relativity? Which is the Einstein's famous equation, not by number of times which is mentioned in the literature,
but by its substance, so to say, by its meaning. And I will repeat this opinion poll again in this audience. Yeah, I will define. So EZ sub-zero is the rest energy. Sorry? So, rest energy equals mass. Let's put C equal to 1. Then energy is equal to rest mass. E equals m0. Then energy equals mass. E, this is the most famous equation. E equals mc squared. And finally, E0 equals m0. This is the fourth equation. So, who is for the first equation? Please raise your hand. One. The first equation is one. Three. Four. Five. Six. Seven.
Eight.
Huh? Eight. Rest mass? Okay. So, eight for the first. No choke, yeah? One is eight. For two, E equals mc squared. Nobody, yeah? Zero. You are frightened. For three, again, zero. You are boycotting my vote, yeah? And finally, four. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Okay. So? To introduce C cube, yeah? So, the most common point of view is that E equals mc squared, and because E changes with velocity, m is also changing with velocity, and this velocity-dependent mass is called relativistic mass. And this mass was in all textbooks at the time which I gave these talks. and the audience would usually vote for two. Yeah. And this is, sorry? As a result of these talks, I wrote in Physics Today and published in 89 an article, and there were very indignant responses defending E equals mc squared. But this point of view was strongly supported by Taylor and Wheeler, and in their second edition, especially in the dialogue, Use and Abuse of the Concept of Mass, they formulated everything
absolutely correctly. And after that, I browsed many textbooks in the United States, later editions of them. And they didn't speak, any author didn't speak about mass which depends on velocity. It disappeared during those 10 years. Yeah, there was an argument with Winkler, yeah, who insisted that it's his right to use any letters for defining whatever. Yeah. But recently, I discovered that this relativistic mass is still present in the explanation of the redshift. And I started to think about that. First, I talked to Dr. Selivanov at ETEP. Then I wrote to Wheeler. And I came to CERN and talked to Professor Walter Legdi. And as a result, we wrote a paper which is called Gravitation, Clocks and Photons, Interpretation of Redshift in a Static Gravitational Field. What we have found that irrespective of how highbrow the author is, how mathematically absolutely correct his derivation of the redshift, still he feels obliged to mention that the redshift appears due to gravitational interaction, due to attraction of the photon by the Earth, in the case of Earth. And it's the analogy with a stone which is thrown and loses its energy, kinetic energy, as it goes up, was the explanation of gravitational redshift in the case of the photon. So formulas may be correct, but the explanation was wrong. And there were many books in which there were correct formulas, wrong interpretation, or several interpretations. On one page, one interpretation, on the other page, another interpretation. And it was terrible in science popular literature, for instance, in Encyclopedia Britannica. But even in such books as Wheeler, Misner, and Thorn, it was not absolutely stressed or explained that there is only one interpretation which is correct of the redshift. Our paper will appear in American Journal of Physics, I believe next month, this month, December. And what I will speak about is essentially about this paper. So there are two kinds of redshifts. One of them is cosmological redshift. It's usually observed from the receding galaxies, and the farther the galaxy is, the more redshifted its emission lines or absorption lines also. And the shift is larger than the wavelengths in many cases. It's up to 5 wavelength, the shift of the wavelength. And there is gravitational redshift. So it's a moving body, and it's mainly Doppler effect. Also it's not completely Doppler effect, not only Doppler effect in that case. Gravitational redshift is a phenomenon which is observed in a static gravitational field when photon moves vertically. And it's redshifted if it moves from down to up, vertically up. In that case, the observed delta lambda over lambda is very small, and it is this gravitational redshift in the static field which is misinterpreted in the books. And usually it's presented in the, by the word that photon climbs out of gravitational well like a stone, and the mass of the photon is its energy divided by c squared. So it's again E equals mc squared, and nobody voted for this here. Now, the genuine explanation of this, the correct explanation, is that the frequency of the clocks of atoms, nuclei, any massive body with a periodic process in it, increases with height, while the frequency of the photon is constant in a static field. And the photon is redshifted, not absolutely, but only with respect to the clocks. Its frequency is a constant. But because clocks are blue-shifted with height, photon is redshifted with respect to the clocks. And that explains the phenomenon of the so-called redshift. Yeah, there is difference. I'll explain why. Yeah. Wait a second. I will explain in detail just what you have asked. So, the whole thing started with theory. It was Einstein who first wrote about gravitational redshift in 1907, and then again in 1911. I have to stress that his famous formula, the rest energy equals mc squared, was derived by him in 1905. That is before he started to consider the redshift. And it was written just in this way, the rest energy, in 1905. But then he changed his mind. Number one. Now it's number one, but it's on my list it was another number. It's not number one. Huh?
Yes, correct.
It was number one, yeah? Okay. Yeah, yeah. Now, in 1907, he changed his mind, and he used the definition of momentum in the same way as Poincaré did it, namely non-relativistically. Momentum equals mass multiplied by velocity, not energy, but mass. Not energy divided by c squared, but mass. And he used this in his paper of 1911 again. He considered gravitational redshift in the framework of special relativity and plus Newton potential, and used the equivalence principle, the elevator, that in a falling elevator you don't feel gravity. And the explanation was the following. The source and absorber are at rest with respect to the Earth. Their height difference is IH. Photon is emitted at moment equal t equals zero, and the gravitational field doesn't act on a photon in a free-falling elevator. Then photon is absorbed at t h divided by c, because in every system photon has velocity c. And at that moment, the absorber moves upward in the elevator reference frame with velocity v equal gt. So to understand this, you have to assume that the elevator is a cylinder with a slot in it, vertical slot. And the absorber and the emitter are on a rod inserted inside the cylinder. And therefore, the elevator falls, and with respect to the elevator, the absorber moves upward. And in the frame of the Earth, it's at rest, but in the frame of reference of the elevator, it goes up. And then you have linear Doppler effect, and you easily get that due to this Doppler effect, delta E is equal E multiplied by D over C. And then E equals H omega, and you get delta omega over omega is minus V over C. And because V is GH over C squared, you get delta omega over omega GH over C squared. So in this case, photon is redshifted with respect to the absorber. Now, pseudo-theory of relativistic mass. In 1905, Einstein wrote E0 mc squared, and for photon m is equal to zero, so rest energy is equal to zero. Whenever there is a mass, there is energy. That was his correct statement, E0 equals mc squared. But in 1911, he wrote that whenever there is energy, there is mass. And this is not correct, because photon has energy and has no mass. And from this, it follows that E gamma equals M gamma C squared, and we got this famous relativistic mass M gamma. And then you apply to this M gamma, to the photon, the non-relativistic equation for photon, M gamma multiplied by GH, as if photon was a stone. And you derive the correct formula. But the correct formula is derived by making drastic mistakes, I would say. Yeah, it's wrong because you get the correct formula for the vertically moving photon, and you get a wrong formula for horizontally moving photon. So you cannot use this changing of words. Let's say mass when there is energy, and then apply non-relativistic approach. And this is the argument. If you apply the same argument to the sun, to the deflection of the light by the sun, you get only one half of the effect. It's written here. When applied to the deflection of light by the sun, the relativistic mass M gamma gives one half of the correct result. And so, in 1916, Einstein derived the correct formula with an extra coefficient 2. But he didn't refer to his previous paper and didn't say that it was a wrong formula in the previous paper. He never mentioned this. And all authors of many books continued using this wrong argument of 1907, 1911 in their books. And students were taught to use this argument. They were cheated. There are several books, and Schwinger wrote a book on gravity, not particles and sources, but there is a special book on gravity which appeared in the Library of Scientific American. And there he says very simply, he says, when photon moves in a static field, we have a static problem, there is no dependence on time, and therefore the frequency of the photon is constant. That is written in Schwinger's book, and that's correct. Vertically moving photon in a static field doesn't change frequency. You solve equation where there is no time dependent, and you got a constant frequency, eigenvalue. It's one of the few popular books on gravity in which this is described, the redshift is described correctly. However, he didn't mention all other explanations as if they don't exist. But if you take, for instance, Wheeler's book on gravity, the popular book, It would be the redshift in the sense of Einstein 1911. And if you take Wheeler, Meissner and Thorn, there will be both explanations on different pages. Just they don't care about trying to explain to a layman. They use this old argument and they don't care about whether the argument is correct or not. Now, in the framework of general relativity, we have this form for the interval. These are the coordinates. And the proper time is interval divided by t. And in the static case, there exists a distinguished time coordinate t, which is x0 divided by c. And the metric tensor doesn't depend on t.
In the case of, say, Earth and photon,
in the static field. This time t has three names.
It's called coordinate name.
Time, sorry. Sometimes it's called world time,
because it is defined for the whole world. And sometimes it's called the laboratory time,
because it's determined by the frequency of the atom or of the clock in your lab, where the photon is emitted. For an observer at rest at point x, tau of x is square root of g00 multiplied by t. So, at for given t, for given universal time, the local time depends on x. Now, let us look at this dependence. Relation between square root of g00 and phi. So this x are coordinates, contravariant, phi are covariant vector. Mc squared is given by this equation. And g00 is one of a contravariant metric tensor is equals the component of it is equal 1 over g00. And for a body at rest in a static field, we have this equation where energy is fourth component or zeroth component of the moment for momentum. And hence, energy is given by this equation. But on the other hand, in a weak field, we have mc squared plus the potential energy. And therefore, square root is just 1 plus phi of x divided by c squared. The standard choice is that at infinity, phi is equal to zero and is negative for finite x. Near the surface of the Earth, we can write that the running radius is r plus h. If h is much smaller than the radius of the Earth, then we have the delta phi, which is GH. Now, let's consider atom or clock at two different heights. And the larger the energy, so the energy increases with height, and the frequency is proportional to energy, and therefore frequency increases with height of every level. And the difference, energy difference of two levels also increases with height, and therefore the frequency between two levels also increases with height. And that is what was presented here. Now there are two phenomena which usually discussed when one speaks about clocks. Namely, clocks go faster, the faster, the higher they are. But on the other hand, they go slower when they are moving. And you can take into account both phenomena and get this formula. So phi and u squared, where u is velocity of the clock, act in different directions, opposite directions. Height and velocity shift the rate of a clock in opposite directions. Now you may tell me that there is only one way to measure the relative, when we measure the frequency, as you have said. We all always have photon and we have atom, and therefore it's always relative. And therefore, to say who is responsible seems to be impossible. I already mentioned this argument by Schwinger, that for a static field there should be no dependence of photon frequency. But there will be another argument, even more stronger one. Usually people ask, what is the difference between a clock and a photon? Why photon cannot be used as a clock? If the photon is confined, say you have a laser and a box where light is reflected and it's pulsating or oscillating with some frequency, and it would be just a normal clock in a sense. There is no difference between confined photon and confined electron. So such a confined photon could be used as a clock, but it's a massive body because you have walls which confine it, and it can be localized. A massive body can be localized, put into some point in space, and used for measurement. However, a free photon cannot be localized because it has zero mass, and when you try to localize it, when you make it softer and softer, you get the localization of the order of the Compton wavelength, 1 lambda gamma, and this is, for a massless photon, is infinity.
And therefore,
photon cannot be used to measure a free photon, cannot be used to measure time at a given point. So it's again, local time can be measured by local massive clocks only, for instance, atoms. A non-confined photon is moving in any reference frame and therefore cannot be used as a local clock. If m gamma is not zero, then the photon's non-locality in its rest frame is 1 over m gamma, so it's huge. The energy e gamma and the frequency omega gamma of a photon in a coordinate time t are conserved, Schwinger's argument. They don't depend on x. Therefore, free photons can be used as clock for universal coordinate time, but not for local time tau. Now about experiments and their interpretation. The first measurement of the redshift was performed by Pound and his co-workers, first Repka, then Snyder, at Harvard in 1960. They used Harvard Tower, which was 22.5 meters high. The source was in the cellar, the detector was on the roof, and then they changed the position of the source and detector, and in this way they measured not the redshift but blue shift. And their result confirmed this formula, GH divided by C squared delta omega over omega, first with 10% accuracy, then with 1% accuracy.
You know, that Pound used to say that he really understood gravity after doing this experiment because there was no elevator to power. He was carrying all the equipment.
That became possible only because of Masbauer effect. Because delta omega over omega, it's estimated here, is 10 to the minus 15. And therefore, without Masbauer, it's impossible to measure such a small frequency shift. So there was source downstairs, there was absorber and detector upstairs, and there was absorber between the detector and the source. And the absorber was the same iron which emitted the photons. And because of the relative shift of the frequency of the photon and of the nucleus, there was no resonant absorption when the clock by the absorber. But if you compensate this shift by a Doppler shift, by slightly moving the absorber, then the resonance absorption is restored. And in this way, by measuring the velocity of the absorber, which was very slow velocity, it was possible to measure this shift. It is interesting. No, it's the same, because if your absorber moves towards the photon, then it compensates redshift. If it moves in the same direction as photon, then it compensates the blue shift. Here are the titles of the papers by Pound and Repka, and of the torque which Pound gave in Moscow at a conference, and the talk was published in Soviet Physics Uspekhi in 61. And you see apparent weight of photons, and just on the weight of the photon. And you see that the... apparent weight was in the photo in the West, yeah, okay. And in Moscow it was just the weight of the photon. So interpretation was in terms of massive photon, in terms of relativistic mass of the photon, of the potential well from which photon climbs and cannot free from this well. Then this experiment was changed technically, but not conceptually. In 79, a rocket was used to send a hydrogen miser to 10,000 kilometers height, and the effect became larger because the effect is proportional to the potential difference. And it was measured with 10 to the minus 4 accuracy. But essentially, the idea of the experiment was the same. And it again measured relative shift of the photon with respect to the atom. There were experiments with so-called null shift. They were solid-state devices based on Josephson junction, and it was just experiments done on a desk with very minor potential difference. But it was again the same, conceptually the same thing. Also, there were measurements of spectrum lines from the sun, not from the Earth, but just the redshift for the sun, it was 5 or 6%. And again, it was the same idea. Rocket, tower, junction, and solar spectrum experiments measure the relative shift of clock and photon. And if you forget about what Schwinger has written, you still may insist that there is no way to tell whether photon is red-shifted absolutely or clocks are blue-shifted absolutely. However, there were experiments also in which there was no photons at all, only clocks. If with height clocks goes faster, then you raise the clock and then you bring it back to your lab and compare your clock with a twin clock which was always in the lab all this time. And if the idea that clocks runs faster and the idea is based on general relativity, because G sub 0, 0 is a square, is 1 plus 2 phi divided by C squared. So if clocks at above in the sky runs faster, then when you bring it back, it will go with the same frequency, with the same rate at your desk, but it will be ahead of the clock which was on the desk all the time, because the integral at the height cannot be erased. It is here. There were round trips of clocks on the airplanes. And there is dependence on whether a strong effect, whether the plane goes eastward or westward. In general relativity of rotating body, it's essential. So this effect has been taken into account. And it was an atomic clock for 80 hours, and with accuracy of 20 nanoseconds, it confirmed, this experiment has confirmed, that the rate of the clock increases with height. Then another group has done similar experiment with five flights at the height of 10 kilometers using telemetry. The history of this experiment is very interesting. The people didn't get money for tickets. It was impossible for them to fly first class, only economy, and they had to take flights which were convenient for companies, not for them, and so on. And this effect has been measured with accuracy of the order of 1%. Airplane experiments measure an absolute effect when the two clocks are directly compared in the lab without any photons. And the clock that was in the sky is ahead of its lab twin. Therefore, we know independently about clocks, and we have a theoretical argument about the photon, that photon shouldn't shift. And therefore, the redshift of the photon is the result of the blue shift of the clock. And that's the end of the story. All explanations which are based on the redshift of the photon due to attraction by the Earth are wrong. And never tell to your students this lie. That's all.
About the original call.
Sorry?
About the original call.
Yeah. I don't quite understand the question. Yeah.
Why not? Why worry about that?
I'm sorry. No, it's not just a parameter. Mass, first of all, you say there is energy and there is momentum.
Right.
And forget about mass. Yeah? But we know... No, but if you tell me, but still remember about the mass, then I don't understand what is your statement. Okay, yeah, fine, yeah, it's invariant. Yeah, it's an invariant. It's E squared minus P squared is M squared. In special relativity, yeah. And therefore, we cannot neglect it. And no, it's not a parameter. I mean, it's a fundamental quantity, physical quantity. And we measure all masses of particles with precision, which is allowed by our experimental means. Yeah. And it's in the particle data. So we cannot forget about it. Yeah. It's invariant with respect to to Lorentz transformations, not to any transformation. Yeah. Yeah. You may say, maybe you would like to phrase your question in a different form. For instance, why to speak about mass when speaking about gravity? Because gravity is determined not by the mass, but by the energy momentum tensor. Yeah. And that is absolutely correct. Therefore, there is no gravitational mass, neither active nor passive. And the gravitational interaction is the interaction between two energy momentum tensors of two bodies. And that's all. And that is absolutely correct. I agree with you. Yeah. You are absolutely right, but if I write E sub zero, that means that energy is the rest energy, and rest energy is energy in a given frame, in the rest frame. And when you have a component in a given frame, it's already an invariant. And therefore, yeah, just because it's a product of two vectors. And therefore, it's an equation which connects two invariant quantities. Rest energy and mass. That's important. No, it's not two names of the same thing, because mass is mass. It's a Newtonian notion, and rest energy is the energy which you can use by using processes in which the rest energy transforms into energy, kinetic energy of other bodies. So this equation, E zero equals mc squared, is of great importance for all our technology. It's fusion, it's all nuclear energy there.
There is a mystery behind it all. The origin is an important.
Of course, yeah. That's Higgs and strings and all other things, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Pointed very clearly to the evolution and the devolution of the concept.
Yeah.
And by now we are so used to the energy momentum tensor, perhaps we should talk more.
No, energy momentum tensor or vector? What you are speaking about?
General
relativity. Of course, it's Yeah. No gravitational mass, no nothing. Yeah, absolutely correct. Yeah. I agree.
Okay, well, thank you,
It was interesting that there was not a single article or book in which all this is explained.
Right.
Yeah. Not a single one.
Well, but the level where it becomes clear when people don't bother to explain.
When I wrote to Wheeler, he said it would be a pity if you kill this second explanation. Because, it climbs out. Because it's always good to have two explanations, two different explanations.
You have to render this point.
No, he said, I'm just used to do this, and I don't know why should I drop my habits.
He also has a textbook, right?
Yeah, he has a textbook on general relativity. Very good one.
He has both. I know, but that's what I'm saying.
And it's very, very dangerous when you look at that image. The second place, the image of your 53 by Robin, using the water.
Whereas in this case, it's still there on 2. Yeah. So that doesn't, okay, so it stands out, so they don't.